here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Tune in to KABU for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KABU will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Michael Dybert, who is the author of a book, In the Shadow of Saint Death. And Michael Dybert will be speaking this next Tuesday, July 8th, at Powell's on Burnside. Starts at 7:30, but it's not a huge room, so you might want to get there early. Anyway, Michael Dybert, welcome to KABU.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's start out. Who is Saint Death? Who is Santa Muerte?
Santa Muerte is kind of a folk saint in Mexico that goes back, quite a number of centuries, and it actually predates the drug war and the drug culture, the narco culture. But it's become a kind of iconographic figure that in the minds of a lot of Mexicans and a lot of people in the United States is associated closely with the kind of, the drug culture that's become a very big presence of life in Mexico, especially along the border with the United States.
Well, this drug war has started, I guess you'd say, started with President Nixon back in 1970 and is still going on. It's done an awful lot of damage.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's horrendous. I mean, I don't know. Do we have any idea the total number of people killed in the drug war since 1970?
Well, I mean, if you look at, Mexico, I mean, the official number now is somewhere between 70,000 and 80,000, and that's since 2006. And then you look at, other countries like Colombia, which, of course, had its own problems with drug-related violence, and which have not ended, and Guatemala, which in some ways has been a bit of a tributary of the drug war that's going on in Mexico. One of the main reasons I wrote the book was I think it's an extremely failed and destructive policy that needs to be reexamined and jettisoned on the part of the United States.
Well, the one thing that interests me is all the linkages between, you have these drug cartels. Now, your book focuses sort of on the drug war between the Gulf Cartel and Los Zetas. So why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, the Gulf Cartel are, for all intents and purposes, the oldest criminal organization in Mexico, unless one counts the PRI, which is the governing party of Mexico. But the Gulf Cartel basically got their start during the prohibition of alcohol in the United States. And they were kind of founded by a farm boy from Tamaulipas, which is a state to the east of Mexico. It's right south of, say, McAllen, Texas, and Brownsville, Texas, on the Rio Grande. And over the years, it grew into smuggling all kinds of different contraband in the United States, and in the 60s expanded to drugs. Now, of course, poppies, opium, and the marijuana have been grown in Mexico for, centuries. But where that kind of coalesced, where the perfect storm kind of happened, was, with all of the violence happening in Colombia, the Colombians were, and all the violence happening in Miami, where I'm speaking to you from, in the late, early to mid-80s, the Colombian narcos were looking for a different route to bring their product into the United States, and that coalesced with the kind of, the expansion of the drug cartels in Mexico, particularly, the Gulf Cartel, which around that time started being led by a man, Juan Garcia Abrego. And he ran the cartel until he was, arrested. And then it fell into a guy called Osiel Cardenas. Now, Osiel Cardenas, in around 1997, basically, gave an offer, a very attractive offer, to some Mexican Special Forces troops to come in and act as military enforcers for the Gulf cartel. And they became known as Los Zetas, the Z's, which is a military radio code in Mexico. And so they basically worked hand in hand for a number of years. Then Cardenas was arrested in 2003 and extradited to the U.S. in 2007. And then, the Zetas kind of started operating more and more on their own. And then in the beginning of 2010, they had a big blow up when one of the Zetas, kind of big guys, was murdered in Reynosa. And then the Gulf cartel and the Zetas fell out. And ever since then, the two cartels have been kind of fighting one another and with among themselves in Nuevo León and in Veracruz and Tamaulipas also.
Well, I think one thing we should remind people is that the Zetas started out to be military people. They were supposedly fighting the drug lords, and they switched sides in effect, didn't they?
Yeah, and the thing is, the first reference that I've been able to find of the Zetas is that they were used to help try and put down the rebellion of the Zapatistas in Chiapas in 1994. Mm-hmm. And, the kind of account of what they exactly did there is somewhat murky. But, yeah, I mean, and another thing is, along with the Zetas, I mean, the Cabiles, who are the kind of special forces of the Guatemalan military, who have a really horrific record of human rights abuses during that country's 30-year civil war, have also become, one of the, I would say, kind of the second string recruits for the Zetas. And there's quite a number of Guatemalans in the organization now, too.
So basically, let's remind people of that the Los Cabiles, they were the death squads of the Guatemalan government, which was sort of put in place by the U.S., call it an invasion, I guess, in 1954.
Yeah, the Cabiles, they were an official unit of the Guatemalan military. They were, the special forces, basically. And, they were, I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to assume that if somebody is willing to murder an entire village of, Indian peasants, that they probably were, they're probably willing to go into drug trafficking as well.
Well, it's like the... I keep hearing some other voice somewhere in the background, but there seem to be all kinds of linkages between the death squads and the military and the politicians, and the drug cartels. Could we explore that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that's important for people to understand about, what they call the drug war, the drug trade, or whatnot, is it's a trade that's made up of a web of official corruption on both the U.S. side of the border and the Mexican side of the border. Now, everyone knows who the kind of Mexican narcos are, Chapo Guzman, the Zetas, people like that. But, not that many people know that, pillars of the U.S. financial community, such as Bank of America and HSBC and Wachovia, have also been, officially indicted and sanctioned for laundering billions, with a B, dollars of drug money. And I think they also don't know that, a huge proportion of the firearms that the Mexican cartels use come from the United States. I have a story story in my book about there's one guy in Texas who I think bought, over 100 assault rifles in, a period of a year or two, which were found at crime scenes all over Mexico. And, in Mexico, the particularly in Tamaulipas, the drug trade has been a government sanctioned and a government, I wouldn't say necessarily organized, but certainly a government overseen endeavor for many, many decades.
Well, you mentioned bankers, and one that you mentioned was Roberto Hernandez, who was in your book, he was one of the people who was at a PRI fundraiser, I guess, in Mexico City. And I've heard insinuations that he was involved with drugs also. He was the president of Banamex, which I believe has been merged into the Citibank people. And he supposedly had a big mansion somewhere and Cancun, where drug shipments were coming in right there. But this...
Well, it's incredibly, you know, it's incredibly... the money produced by drug trafficking is an integral part of the global economy. And I think this is something that a lot of people don't know. I mean, you know, when there was the big financial collapse in about 2008, the head, the head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime said that during that crisis, that criminal groups, specifically Mexican, had the only liquid investment capital available to a lot of banks. And he said that around $352 million in drug profits were laundered through the economic system, and that, you know, those loans between banks were funded by money that originated from the drug trade and other illegal activities from organized crime.
Well, I think a lot of people, when you think about it, you know, the drug money once it's laundered, it is clean money. And where does it go?
Yeah.
I mean, it goes...
Well, and the other thing is, I think, you know, with this... with this problem that we have in the United States, I mean, there's a great deal of money being made by keeping narcotics illegal. I mean, I have some, you know, information in the book about the private prison industry in the United States, which between 1989 and 2009 grew 1,600%. And, you know, these private prison industry, kind of the big companies there, I mean, they're instrumental in lobbying for things like mandatory minimum sentencing related to narcotics, you know, expansion of immigration enforcement, things like that. So this is a, you know, these are companies that are making, you know, millions and millions of dollars a year by punishing, well, let's face it, I mean, punishing poor and minority people disproportionately for their role in the drug trade, when, as we've seen, the people who are the real groundies are people in suits and ties in beautiful offices.
Well, the prison industry, their profits depend on more people. You know, they require a certain number of prisoners to make any money.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I and some other people are really hoping is, I mean, I use the example of Portugal in the book. I mean, I think the solution for the violence that we have, because, I mean, sometimes people say, you know, well, there's violence in Mexico, but there's no violence in the United States. In Miami and Chicago and all of these places surrounded, you know, connected to the drug trade. And I think a general decriminalization of narcotics, similar to what Portugal did in 2000, is something that the United States has to seriously examine. And I think the states, you know, Colorado, Washington State, by their decriminalization of marijuana, it's a step in that direction. I'd like to see it go a lot further. But I think, you know, the states are showing the way in a way the federal government has been too cowardly to do.
Well, this is my name is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire, and we are talking with Michael Dybert, who is the author of In the Shadow of Saint Death, and he will be speaking at Powell's on Burnside next Tuesday. That's July 8th, Tuesday at 7:30, and you might want to get there a little sooner because the room fills up pretty fast sometimes. But let's talk while. This, I guess the president of Mexico who really pursued the drug war was Felipe Calderón.
Yeah.
And he was, well, he won a disputed election in 2006. Well, there have been so many disputed elections, I think, going way back. But can you tell us a little bit about Calderón?
Well, Calderón is a complicated character. I mean, his father was one of the founders of the PAN, which is the National Action Party. It's kind of the main opposition party to the PRI, which is the party that had governed Mexico historically for about 70 years until it was defeated in an election by Vicente Fox, who was also a PAN guy in 2000. But the PAN is, I would say, it's not necessarily a monolithic organization. You have different kind of political philosophies within it. You know, and Calderón, he was a deputy from Michoacán, which is, you know, the state he's a native of, which is a state that has been as torn apart by drug trafficking as any in all of Mexico, I would say, including up till today. And, you know, it's complicated because the situation in Mexico was becoming extremely violent even before Calderón came to office. I mean, I always point to the attempt of the Sinaloa cartel to take over in Nuevo Laredo from the Gulf Cartel in the Zetas, which happened about 2004, 2005, and Calderon came in 2006. But, you know, the military in Mexico is not trained to do law enforcement duties. In other words, you know, there's a big difference, obviously, in a city like Portland as opposed to just seeing the police. If you saw the Army of the United States doing police work, I think most people would find that pretty alarming. And it was much the same in Mexico, although in some areas, you know, the thing is, in a state like Tamaulipas, I mean, the cartel, the Gulf cartel basically is the state police of Tamaulipas. And that's the case in a lot of states in Mexico. So the local police don't do law enforcement as we would think of them doing. But the thing that I think is really important for people to understand is that since Calderon left, you know, and Peña Nieto has been president for a couple of years now, nothing has changed. Peña Nieto has a much better PR machine than Calderon had. But the level of violence in Mexico, if anything, has in a lot of areas gotten worse. And, you know, in Tamaulipas last year, the murder rate increased 90%. That's 90, not 9.
Oh, really?
Wow. Percent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and there's wars being fought all over Tamaulipas, all over Veracruz, all Michoacán, Sinaloa, Guerrero. Mexico State, which is the state that surrounds the capital, the federal district, you know, has also been extremely, extremely violent in mm-hmm. recent months. So this idea that there's a rhetorical change, I would say, with Peña Nieto, where he's not necessarily parading the narcos in front of the cameras like Calderon did and making a big show of it, but I don't think on the ground much has changed at all.
Well, when he was elected, you know, you heard... I don't know, some of the pundits are saying, well, things are going to change, that the root of the drug war or the violence was these different cartels fighting over territory, and that apparently, according to these stories, Pri kind of kept the peace by favoring one cartel over the other, kind of sort of loaning out its the peacekeeping duties to the Sinaloa cartel. Now, is there any truth to that at all?
I mean, I think there have been historically, not just with the PRI, but with the PAN and with the PRD, especially at the local level, there are organic relationships with different drug cartels that go back, you know, many, many years. And, but, you know, in terms of this, my impression, at least, is that it's much less frightening for people to think that, okay, there's a modus vivendi between the politicians and the cartels that keeps everything in order. In my experience in Mexico, the situation is much more chaotic and unpredictable than that. You know, there can be an understanding for some period of time, and then that breaks down. And, you know, I mean, we saw, you know, Ciudad Juarez for many years was a fairly, you know, it wasn't necessarily a pleasant place, but it was a fairly calm and peaceful place. And then when the Sinaloa cartel tried to invade and you know, took over the city basically from the Juarez cartel. And all of these cartels, it's very interesting. You know, the Sinaloa cartel, the Juarez cartel, the Tijuana cartel, they trace their roots back to the Guadalajara cartel, which was kind of the first big Mexican cartel that broke up in the 1980s, which and all trace their roots back to Sinaloa, which is a Pacific Coast state in Mexico. And, you know, that's what makes a bit the Gulf cartel unique, is that they started with no connection to the Sinaloa people. They started in Tamaulipas, you know, on the Gulf Coast as opposed to the Pacific Coast. And I think that the situation now is so unpredictable in Mexico. You know, I mean, you can't drive from Matamoros to Ciudad Victoria anymore on the highway because there's no telling what would happen. You can't drive from Reynosa to Matamoros, which is, you know, a 30-minute drive. Well, no, maybe an hour drive. You know, but I remember talking to a journalist in Ciudad Juarez who said, this was in 2010 when I talked to him, he said that, you know, 10 years earlier, no one from Juarez would go to Mexico City because they thought it was too dangerous.
Oh, really?
And that, yeah, and that obviously has slipped now. The one place things are a bit calm is in Mexico City itself because, I mean, from everything I've gathered, the narcos think that that's kind of neutral ground where they can go and relax from the drug wars. Although there have been some incidents such as the kidnapping of a bunch of kids from a nightclub, you know, about maybe 15 months ago or so that have, you know, really chilled that a bit. But I don't think there's necessarily one person or one, you know, one entity with its hand on the throttle, as much as the Mexican state in different aspects tries to be. I don't think there's really anyone that thoroughly in control.
Well, one thing you mentioned in your book is the Los Zetas. You know, they kind of expanded, they diversified. You know, from being a drug cartel to one of the things they do is they prey on deportees.
Yeah, they prey on deportees both as a source of income and a source of manpower, personnel. And then the thing is if you go to these bus stations in places like Matamoros or Reynosa, the United States instituted a policy a couple of years ago whereby if you're deported from the United States, they intentionally will drop you off at the point of departure farthest away from where you're based in Mexico to kind of discourage you from ever doing it again. Well, I mean, that might seem like a good kind of vindictive idea to some person in Washington, but what it does is it gets a lot of these young men in places where they have no resources at all. And so, they're both prey, both as I said, personnel and as victims. And the other thing they do is, the Zetas are by far, I would say, the most, dominant in terms of preying on migrants heading north, especially on La Bestia, the beast, which is, these trains that go up from southern Mexico to the border. And then, one of the great massacres that happened in Tamaulipas a couple of years ago was when the Zetas killed many dozens of immigrants who were trying to make their way to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know it's the default position of my home country, the United States, in some ways, to try and have a military solution to everything. But the military solution to the drug war and to the immigration problem has, if it's done anything, it's given the, it's made the life and the income stream of the Zetas and groups like it easier, because it's forcing immigrants into a narrower cordon where they can be preyed upon. So we're ostensibly fighting drug trafficking, but we're providing the drug traffickers with income by which they can continue drug trafficking. That, to me, does not sound like a very effective or far-sighted policy.
And we're providing guns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, of course, now we have this. This is fairly recent. This wave of young people crossing the border, and it's how does that relate to this drug war?
Well, there's been quite a bit of discussion as to whether or not that this is a specific tactic of some of the cartels to kind of distract the the border patrol and whatnot while they're moving loads across. But the thing is I mean, these organizations are so skilled and they've been doing this for so long. I think they would probably have a more sophisticated system than that. But, I mean, which is one of the things where this Secure Fence Act they tried to implement in 2006, where the solution to drug trafficking was they were going to build a fence, along the whole border, which ended up costing $3.9 million per mile, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that these guys with 737s loaded with cocaine landing in the Mexican countryside are going to see a 20-foot fence and decide to stop trafficking drugs is laughable and cynical at the same time, I think. And so, I think this militarized approach to immigration and the militarized approach to the drug war, again, with the, military metaphors, I think has been misguided. And I think it has had the opposite effect of what its proponents claim that they want to achieve.
Well, one weird thing about this border fence, besides the fact that it doesn't work, is that it cuts across U.S. territory, and some American citizens find themselves on the wrong side of the fence.
Well, yeah, and it's preposterous. I mean, if you drive around, Brownsville and that area of Texas and the Rio Grande Valley, you'll see people who have had their family farms and in Texas for years. They're American citizens, and now they're on the other side of the wall. In other words, push towards the cartels and towards Mexico. And at one point, they were going to construct the fence, cutting off a large section of the University of Texas at Brownsville. And, when the people at the University of Texas at Brownsville obviously said, no, that's not a good idea, they said they were going to go off and study it some more. And at one point in Arizona, they built quite a number of miles of the fence in Mexico, illegally, basically taking Mexican territory, which, as you know, the United States has a bit of a history of in that part of the world. It's just you can't wage war against the alienation that makes people want to do drugs, and you can't wage war against an unbeatable market force. So I would say, in terms of the drug problem in the United States, the approach should be one of treatment and dissuasion, and not. If somebody's an alcoholic, you don't put them in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the solution that we have, it seems, for drug dependency and drug abuse.
It's a little bit of a sidebar. Does the Rio Grande still reach the Gulf of Mexico? I heard that it kind of stops at a big sandbar outside of Brownsville. Is that true?
It's a little, I haven't seen it at the Gulf of Mexico, but the Rio Grande is a very, it's not very grand anymore, let's put it that way. It's a little trickle the couple of last times I've been to that part of the country.
Well, it's kind of a symptom of global warming, which is hurting farmers all over the world, especially in Mexico. What about the, you know, recently there's been these kind of self-defense groups forming, and I've been wondering when that was going to happen, and apparently, is that a growing movement?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the place where it first started to a large degree was Michoacán, and then it took off a little bit in Guerrero and Veracruz, and there's been some, you know, rumblings in Tamaulipas itself. It's quite complicated, and I have not been on the ground in Michoacán, so it's hard for me to assess it. But, you know, some wings of the auto defense groups, as they call them, are, you know, sanctioned by the government, basically. Mm-hmm. And some wings, it seems like the government is more leery of. Now, I think a lot of Mexicans would say basically the ones that the government approves of are probably dirty and somehow tainted with drug trafficking, because that's kind of one of the government's jobs in Mexico a lot of the time. And so, it's you know, they recently arrested a kind of well-known auto-defense leader in Michoacán and put him in jail, claiming that he was, you know, he was violating the law by parading around with arms and stuff. Well, these guys have been doing that for well over a year now. So why they would pick this one guy to arrest is kind of curious. But I worry, and I think a lot of people in Mexico worry a bit, that what we might be seeing is something similar to what we saw in Colombia in the 1990s, which is, you know, a bunch of different self-defense groups were formed, became the AUC, which was the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which were run by a guy called Carlos Castaño, who were kind of a wing of the Colombian, not kind of, they were a wing of the Colombian army. They were not acknowledged as such, but that's how they operated. And, you know, if something like that would happen in Mexico, I think things could get, if anything, even worse. I think probably there's a number of these self-defense groups that are motivated by a desire to take back their communities from these awful criminals, because, you know, there's no, I have no romanticism about the drug barons and narcos, but I think also there's a very big danger that number one, some of these self-defense groups are involved perhaps with a rival group in whatever area they operated, a rival drug group, and also they're co-opting by the government, which is not exactly transparent or accountable or just in the eyes of many Mexicans, I would say.
Well, one thing, some of these drug gangs, I mean, they've some of them have been dealing in extortion, you know, taking land from peasants and everything to grow their drugs and everything. And I think you mentioned one place, it was the Zetas were running a coal mining operation somewhere.
Yeah, in Coahuila. That's kind of, as I said, you had mentioned it earlier, but I think something that people have to understand is that these drug cartels are multinational, multi-level, diversified criminal organizations, of which drug trafficking is a very important source of their income, but it's not their only income. They do, as you said, extortion. They do theft of natural resources. They do the exploitation of migrants. They also do contraband, you know, CDs, clothes, things like that. So these aren't, you know, these aren't kind of shoeless campesinos hustling loads of coke across the Rio Grande. I mean, it's much more complicated than that.
Well,
that's something people have to understand. Yeah,
and all this newly laundered drug money. I mean, that gets invested in sort of the global capitalist racket too. But I guess we're going to have to end there. I hear my music playing. We've been talking with Michael Dybert, the author of In the Shadow of St. Death, and he will be at Powell's on Burnside next Tuesday, July 8th at 7:30. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay tuned now, because coming up is Air Cascadia.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland with 1 minute before 10 o'clock. Eric Cascady is next, also coming up this morning in 15 minutes on Flashpoints at 10:15. The U.S. pushes successfully for the remilitarization of Japan. Native Americans roughed up and detained at AT&T Park in San Francisco get an apology and a pair of tickets, but they want much more. And a report from the Gaza Strip on the deadly impact of continuing Israeli bombing there. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lynn Molik speaks with author and editor Todd Davies about her latest book in the Jam Today series, Jam Today 2, The Revolution Will Not Be Catered. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Rashonda Tate Billingsley, author of 30 books, including Let the Church Say Amen, which has been made into a movie. But first, it is Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, at Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.